Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the managing editor at Crosscut. As former head of the Department of Homeland Security under President Barack Obama, Janet Napolitano has an inside view of what national security really means. In her book, How Safe Are We? Homeland Security Since 9/11, she discusses the difference between real and perceived threats, and her thoughts on the Trump administration's approach. During last year's Crosscut Festival, she spoke with David Plotz, CEO of Atlas Obscura and co-host of Slate's Political Gabfest. They talked about Russian interference in the 2016 election, the massive political divide facing the country, and much more. This conversation is sponsored by Alaska Airlines and Comcast. It was recorded on May 3rd, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you guys hear us?
Okay.
So, Janet Napolitano, you are you're the president of a college. You were a secretary of
Homeland Security.
You were governor and you were an attorney general. So do we call you president or secretary or general or governor?
Janet works just fine.
Okay, we'll do that. So you have a new book out, which is called How Safe Are We?
Mm-hmm.
So how safe are we?
Well, and in some areas, we're safer now than we were before 9/11. It's difficult to imagine an attack like 9/11, where aircraft were weaponized and flown into iconic buildings, succeeding in the United States today. But in other areas, we're not as safe as we could be. And I would put into that category risks associated with cybersecurity, risks associated with global warming and climate change, and the risks associated with mass gun violence, mass casualty events.
So dig into one of those. Pick one. You can have climate change or cybersecurity.
Let's pick cyber.
Okay. So what ways are we unsafe? How might an attack come that could really threaten us? What should we do about it?
So, let's go back to 9/11. So, in the aftermath of 9/11, there was a commission appointed to kind of reverse engineer how that attack occurred. And what it identified were a number of red flags that were apparent, an increase in the number of foreign nationals attending flight schools and learning how to take off but not how to land airplanes, for example.
Was that true that I've always thought that was a myth.
No. But the key critique was that in our leadership, there was a failure of imagination to see how all of that could come together and result in a mass attack with thousands of people losing their lives. In the cyber world now, we have lots of red flags. We have lots of probing of the systems. We have hacks. We have small denial of service attacks. We have thefts of personal information. But what we don't have is any kind of comprehensive cyber strategy for how we're going to deal with that. And so what I recommend in my book is that we have kind of almost a pre-9/11 commission, i.e. let's not wait until we have a massive attack, but let's bring together the leaders of the public and the private sector, and I identify 10 specific areas that need to be addressed. Everything from how should the federal government be better organized, where questions of cybersecurity are concerned, up to and including how do we define an act of cyber warfare, and what are the sanctions that should attach to that?
Is there a case that we've had an act of cyber warfare? Is what happened in the 2016 election an act of cyber warfare, or is that different than what you're describing?
You know, I think it actually could be characterized as an act of cyber warfare. It was a direct attack on our democracy. And the concern I have, and I think it's shared by many, is that now, having spent 2 years kind of unpeeling the onion as to what Russia was doing in our 2016 election, what have we done to mitigate that risk for 2020? And I got to tell you, I cannot identify a lot that we have done.
So if there were an act of cyber war, what are the kinds of acts of cyber war that we should be worried about?
Well, one is, and we've seen this actually occur in other areas of the country, is a massive denial of service attack, where, for example, you get into the networks that operate all of the utilities of a city, and you shut them down. And all of a sudden, you have a massive blackout. In fact, when I was Homeland Security Secretary, we did a presentation in a secure facility underneath the Capitol. It's called a SCIF. And it was myself, it was the head of the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, the National Counterterrorism Center, the Attorney General, Secretary of Defense. I mean, all of the people at the leadership level of security in our country, briefing members of the Congress on how such an attack could occur and how relatively easy it would be to accomplish such an attack. And so we had General Keith Alexander, who was head of the NSA, just, you know, put it right out there and did a demonstration. Our hope was that it would prompt Congress to pass cybersecurity legislation. They ultimately passed a bill not nearly as strong as the one that I think is required, but they got a start.
Are those, this is a side note, are those SCIFs really cool or are they dingy?
It depends on which SCIF you're talking about. The SCIF
which is like the Four Seasons.
Yeah, SCIF. No. There's some SCIFs that are really nice. They're mostly pretty dingy. Yeah, yeah. So SCIFs are these rooms where you got to leave all your electronics outside, your phones and everything in them, and they cannot be penetrated by outside powers, so to speak. So they're super secret.
No windows.
No windows.
As a citizen, one of the things that I find so strange and alarming is that the most common form of terrorism in the United States these days, of domestic terrorism, appears to be from white nationalists, people motivated by an extreme, you know, sort of fascist, white nationalist, far right ideology. But the current administration does not seem to want to treat that terrorism in the way that they treat terrorism that's motivated by a religious, Islamic religious motivation. How can this administration learn that this matters?
Well, how does this administration learn? Look, what you've just said is true, that we've had more deaths related to right-wing motivated terrorism than Islamist terrorism, I think there's a growing public awareness of this. I think that we still, as a country and in the law enforcement community, don't have a good handle on any kind of prevention or intervention strategy. I think, unfortunately, we're likely to see more of these types of events as we move forward.
Okay, but so what do we do? I mean, there has to be strategies. I mean, there have been strategies that we've adopted for other forms of terrorism.
Well, so, one of the things that we should we should do is kind of back up the bus and say, well, what are the causal factors here? We know that typically it is males of a certain age. Many of them are socially isolated. They are online a lot and get radicalized online. And so we know how to identify that population. What we don't have a good handle on is what causes an individual of that profile to then go the next step and go out and buy a combat-ready weapon and take it out on a church or a university or a school. And, you know, I almost think that we ought to deploy some of our public health methodologies, not just law enforcement methodologies, and really dig into kind of the personality profiles of these individuals and see if we can unlock some better clues so that we can identify earlier who these individuals are.
I think almost everyone probably in this room has been frustrated by the nature of the conversation about immigration and about President Trump's desire to build a wall and the rise in nativism. What, as a kind of, both as a former border state governor and as a former secretary of DHS, what do you make of the conversation that we're having about immigration and national security now? And how can it be rescued?
Well, so first of all, I think we should have a more comprehensive understanding of what the border is. A zone. It's a zone that extends 1,940 miles across the southern United States. It crosses private land, public land, sovereign Indian nations. Through the ports of entry along that border, traverse thousands of trucks and cars every day. Mexico is our third leading trading partner. And the zone needs to be managed. It's not in crisis, by the way. But it does require management, better management than we've seen lately. It requires strengthening the ports of entry, more technology, manpower right there. It requires a partnership with Mexico because they share that border with us. And it requires a strategy of manpower, ground sensors, tunnel detection equipment, air cover, drones between the ports of entry. And then for the current influx of migrants seeking asylum, we need to, I think about it as, you know, kind of flood the zone with the rule of law, bring more immigration judges to the border, bring more administrative law judges from other departments, give them some training on immigration law, send them to the border as well, so that when families with children appear and make their claims for asylum, they can come across, have their credible fear hearings promptly, and then have their cases resolved firmly under the rule of law that we have.
Do you think that those kind of reforms, should they take effect, which they clearly are not going to with this administration, but should they take effect, that we would end up sending back to Guatemala and Honduras most of those people who've come, or do you think we would end up accepting them in some fashion? Do you know the answer to that?
You know, I don't. It depends on the facts. And I think that, you know, we should be informed by the facts. I also believe, however, that we should, rather than investing in a wall, be investing in the source of what's causing people to leave their homes, leave Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador, you know, go on that very difficult journey through Mexico to get to safety in the United States. You know, we had a similar experience with Colombia years ago, where Colombia was a narco state. The United States had something called Plan Colombia, And we invested. We worked with Colombians who didn't want to live in a narco state. And we really went at it persistently. It took some years, but, you know, now Colombia is a tourist destination.
I'd live there. I'd immigrate there, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you been there? It's an amazing country now.
Yeah, yeah. It's beautiful. So, yeah. So you know, we know how to... The point is, we know how to do this, but it takes will and it takes persistence in order to get it done.
Do you think... And I don't know enough about this issue to know, but is there any element of this migration from Central America that is a climate migration in the way that if you think about the Syrian refugees, like in some sense, all the Syrian refugees are climate refugees because of the instability of the economy and the instability of the agriculture.
Yeah.
Is that what's also happening in Central America?
Yeah. You know, they've been infested by something called coffee rust, which has decimated those crops. And as we've seen in other parts of the world where climate-related disasters have occurred that disrupt the local economy. You disrupt the local economy. You have young men jobless, kind of hopeless. You know, resorting to gangs, gang violence. You know, it becomes part of a cycle.
And so, talk a little bit more about then climate as an element of national security and of border security.
So, and I talk about this in my book. I think actually climate is probably the greatest kind of existential risk that we face in the homeland. We see it affecting migration patterns across the planet. We're seeing a great global migration from south to north. We see it in areas of the world that have been afflicted by great drought that's destroyed the local agricultural economy. So Syria, Yemen, you know, can all be traced to climate conditions. We see it in the countries of Central America that we've just been talking about, and so you know, what do we do about it standpoint? Well, the first thing we have to do is acknowledge it. The second thing we need to do is do our part to slow the rate by which carbon is entering the atmosphere. So the Paris Accords would be a start. Next, we need to focus on adaptation. And another area where climate affects us is in, you know, these extreme weather events that we've seen in the United States. Greater number of landfall hurricanes, greater numerosity and intensity of tornadoes, drought in the western United States leading to massive wildfires, and the attendant loss of life and property. You know, climate-related disasters have caused more loss of life in the United States than any terrorism in the last 10 years.
I actually don't want to leave immigration yet because I want... This is a kind of mental exercise for all of you. So imagine that you are at a wedding. You're going to a wedding. You're sitting at table 6. And seated next to you at table 6 is Kristen Nielsen, the former Secretary of DHS, one of your successors. Like, what do you do? Has she lost the right to be in polite society because of the policies that she pursued as Secretary of DHS?
I think her legacy will forever be tarred by the family separation policy. That policy I emanated from the Attorney General announcing zero tolerance at the border, which sounds really good. Sounds really tough, but in reality, it meant that every individual caught crossing the border illegally was immediately put into the criminal justice side, not into the civil deportation side. That makes a difference because then you had to separate children from families. And once you made that decision, and by the way, that's prosecuted. These are federal misdemeanors. You're talking about taking prosecution resources from cases involving the cartels and gun smuggling and human trafficking and putting them into federal misdemeanor cases. So that was a dislocation of resources. But then you had to separate children from families, which meant the children go into the custody of Health and Human Services. And there was no pre-planning for how that was going to occur, at least no planning that I've been made aware of, and certainly no planning done to reunite children with their families. So it was a bad, zero tolerance is a bad policy, badly executed, contrary to, you know, really, I think, a good law enforcement strategy and contrary to our values.
Is why, given how horrid those images are, the videos are, the photographs, why do you think this administration has been so blasé about it and so willing to continue it? Is the cruelty the point?
You know, I'm going into the realm of speculation here, because I think you're asking me to get into the heads of the administration, which is difficult.
Do you know any of them?
No, I don't, and I haven't spoken with any of them. They haven't called me for advice.
Did you know like the Bush people?
Yeah, when
you succeeded.
Yes, actually, it's an interesting contrast. When President Obama took over from President Bush, my predecessor, Michael Chertoff, invested a great deal in the transition from DHS from him to me. He made sure that I was fully briefed. He sent to my governor's office in Arizona, reams of material, met with me and was available during my tenure for an occasional phone call or question. I mean, it was a very kind of, it's what you want in government, right? It was a very professional transition from one administration to the next, what happened with the transition to Trump is there was no transition. The Obama team had prepared, much as the Bush team had, for an extensive transition process, but the Trump team wasn't ready to take the ball. So I think a lot got dropped. And you know, as you know, we can, you know. There are better ways. I'll just put it that way. There are better ways.
I'm very politic of you. So, actually, that gets to another thing I wanted to talk about. You were the governor of Arizona, which is a state you were, I don't know, it was not very Democratic when you were the governor, I don't think. You had a Republican legislature, probably?
Both houses, yeah.
So, you know well the partisan division that the country is facing, that we've overwhelmingly seem to be sorting ourselves so that we're living next to people who we share political beliefs with, we share cultural beliefs with, share religion with, and we don't have as much interaction with people who differ from us, and that partisanship has become this strong divide, which it wasn't a generation ago or two generations ago. People now are get very worked up about the prospect of their child marrying someone who is from the other political party.
What I don't know. You had me sitting next to Kirsten Nielsen at a wedding, so.
Yeah. Whose wedding was it, do you think? What wedding could you be invited to that you both would be at?
God, who knows?
Yeah. So you're sitting next to her at a wedding. No. So seriously, what this is. I mean, I hesitate to speak for this crowd, but I'm guessing this is probably a pretty like-minded crowd. These are probably, I bet most people here are Democrats, progressives, and there's a lot of talking to people you already know and agree with. And yet there's this tremendous division. How, in your experience of actually having to govern in a state where there was tremendous division, do we get past this or treat it?
You know, look, there's no magic formula for this. And politics has become even more partisan since I was in elected office. So I left elected office in 2009 to join the Obama administration. But, you know, my approach in Arizona to get elected was to listen, talk with people, to acknowledge where we disagreed, and to say, but this is what I'm going to do, and this is how I'm going to go about doing it. And it was interesting. So when I was governor, I vetoed like 150 bills. I had a self-inking stamp, so it was good. And, you know, with every veto, there's a veto message. And I took great care in crafting those messages because I wanted the people of Arizona to know what I was doing and why I was doing it. And it was interesting. I would have people come up to me kind of spontaneously saying, you know, Janet, you know, I really disagreed with this or that, but, you know, I appreciate the way you went about doing it, or I appreciate what you said. So that kind of effort to keep reaching out and to work it, you know, it doesn't come naturally, but you got to keep working it, because, you know, in the end, there are some fundamental things that we have in common.
We'll return to the conversation in just a minute. But first, a message from our sponsor, Alaska Airlines. Alaska flies to over 115 destinations worldwide, with an average of 1,200 daily flights across the United States, Mexico, Canada, and Costa Rica. Every Alaska flight has high-speed Wi-Fi, free chat, free movies, a rotating seasonal menu, and the highest-rated customer experience of any North American airline. Alaska also tops the charts in environmental sustainability, having been ranked the most fuel-efficient U.S. airline for 7 years running. It's the highest-rated U.S. airline on the Dow Jones Sustainability Index, and it helps passengers offset the carbon impact of every trip they take. Learn more and book your next trip at alaskaair.com.
But you watched, like probably all of us, 8 years of the Obama presidency, where there was a lot of reaching out by President Obama towards Republicans, and there was nothing in return, where the partisan divisions increased, the violence of rhetoric has only increased, the kind of division in social media has increased. I mean, is the model you just described even possible? Is it even accessible anymore?
You know, one would hope. Washington D.C. in a way reflects the worst of our politics now. I think in part it's because of the way elections are carried out, the way the money flows in elections and the like. But you see examples of what I'm talking about in cities and states across the United States. Not all politics, not all government occurs in Washington, D.C.
So you still have hope that the way things work at a local level, the way things work in states, these divisions are overcomable or healable in some way?
And I think we have to keep working it. I mean, we can't just write off Washington, D.C. And at some point, we have to reward candidates who are making a persuasive case. I use a pragmatic case for how we govern in today's polity.
Can you think of an example, a recent example of someone who is doing that?
In Washington, D.C.?
I mean, ideally, but if you need to fall back to like Kansas, you can.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. And I'll just pick one. I think Senator Mark Warner of Virginia is a ranking member of the Senate Intelligence Committee. They've been doing their own Russia investigation. He's been working with Senator Burr of North Carolina. You don't see the same kind of division you had between Devin Nunes and Adam Schiff. They've been just, you know, quietly and thoroughly going about their work. I think it's taken effort by both of them. We'll have to see what they find out, but yeah.
Okay.
Hope springs eternal.
Yeah.
Don't give it up.
It's hard. I mean, don't you get a little despondent?
Look, I was the Secretary of Homeland Security. I saw a lot of bad stuff.
How was that? I mean, I don't know if you've ever read these stories about people who are moderators on Facebook and they have to pull down offensive content on Facebook, and often they're working in an office park in the Philippines, and it's just images of horrific image after image after image, and it just wears them down, and they really get dark. Does that happen when you're the Secretary of Homeland Security, where every day it's like, oh my God, really? They're up to that.
So I'll give you I would begin my day. I would get what's called the President's Daily Brief, the PDB. The President under Obama, would get two. One was on security. One was on the economy. The PDB is distributed to maybe 10 or 12 people in Washington, D.C., the president, the vice president, DHS secretary, the head of the Joint Chiefs, you know, that level. I would be met at my office first thing in the morning with the PDB. It was in a leather binder. And contained in there was all of the intel from around the world, gathered, collated, analyzed by the CIA. You would be met. You had your assigned briefers from the agency, and you would go through that binder every morning. I kind of called it the "Who's Trying to Kill Us Now" binder. And that's the way I started my day. But you know, doing that every day, you began to see trends. Recognize, you would see some of the same names all the time. Would be able to ask your briefers questions, and they'd go and do some research and come back. I from that derived a great deal of respect for the intelligence apparatus of the United States. It is populated by really smart people doing really hard work, and they do a very good job.
Do you worry that the current low morale in government, in federal government in particular, is going to lower the quality of the people who are in service, or lower the quality of the work of the people who are in service, because it's depressing to have to carry out that stupid separation policy, for example?
I worry when the leadership of the country expresses skepticism, denigrates the work of the intelligence community, for example. And you know, we are a nation of laws, and we're a big, complicated country, and it requires a big, complicated, I'll use the word, bureaucracy, to run it, and it requires people with expertise on everything from satellite construction to earthquake detection to gang violence prevention, and you need to keep filling that civil service with people who are there to serve. And we do not, as a country, recognize those people adequately. And I worry that becomes a deterrent for our best and brightest to go into public service.
Yeah, for sure. Do you, just a couple more questions, and then we're going to go to your questions. Do you worry that, I just had such a good question, I lost my train of thought.
Do I worry?
Do you worry? You worried? I'll move on to something else. So you're president of a university system, a very good university system, and this comes at a time when I think from different directions people are casting doubt on the value of a university education. There's the wow, this is incredibly expensive, given what you know, given that you're just being indoctrinated with stupid liberal ideas. This is. You know, why are you studying the humanities? You should just be learning some STEM stuff over here. Don't bother with the humanities. There's the sense. I think there's a kind of anti-elitism that has especially crept in to some conservative circles. How do you make the really strong case for well-funded public universities and private universities?
Well, I run the University of California, which I'll say is the best public research university system on the planet. So it just is. I know there's some UW fans here, but which is a very good school, by the way. In American history, there has been no better tried and true tactic for social mobility and dealing with income inequality than getting a quality higher education. I mean, the data is absolutely clear. And that's why there's such a demand to go to university. So the University of California, we get hundreds of thousands of applications every year. 42% of our undergraduates are the first in their families to go to college. 38% are Pell Grant recipients, meaning they come from families that make less than $50,000 a year. They graduate. We have very, very high graduation rates. And they go on to do marvelous things. And one statistic is that of our students who come from the bottom decile of income earners, from their families, within 5 years, they are all making more than five times what their family makes. I mean, that is something that a public university can do at scale that no other institution in our society can do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Come on. I remember the question I was going to ask, which is just going back, again, casting back to your DHS days, what do you think in your experience, is the biggest gap between what the public believed and what you knew? What was the greatest misperception that we as a public had about the homeland security or the security of the nation compared to what you actually knew to be the truth?
Well, so
don't breach any national security secrets here, though.
I'll give you one example. So, during my time as secretary, we received a constant stream of threats to aviation security. aviation is still viewed by terrorists as kind of a gold standard, right? Because of what happened on 9/11. And so all of those annoying things you have to do at the airport, you know, taking off your shoes, not taking your liquids on the planes. I'll just tell you that those are not without a security-based reason. Now, I do hope at some point the technology will evolve so that people can leave their shoes on and take their liquids onto planes. And if that had happened while I was secretary, maybe I'd be running for president today.
Yeah, if we could only take like 4.8 ounces of toothpaste on, you would definitely be president.
There you go.
All right, last question before we go to questions. So one of the things that I find so depressing about President Trump is that he has a great affinity for instilling fear in people, and that he loves to do it. And it's terrible to instill fear in people when either that fear is unjustified or B, they can't do anything about that fear. As Secretary of Homeland Security and in your book, you know, you have to grapple with this balance between the fear that we maybe should have about certain threats to us and our ability to go through life in a free society and be, you know, share and travel and connect. So how do we keep that balance between fear and freedom?
Well, I think, the way I think Homeland Security ought to be done is to invite the American people to be participants in their own security, to empower people. The See Something, Say Something campaign was an example of that. Ready.gov, the website where we have all the material that teaches one, you know, how to be prepared for a natural disaster of whatever type. That's another one. You know, knowledge is power, and people need to feel empowered, not fearful. You know, we're a country inherently of problem solvers, and people need information in order to problem solve.
All right, we're going to go to your questions, which are excellent, by the way. Good job. So, a question from Mary. How did your parents and community empower you as a young girl or young woman to believe you could become a governor, a secretary, a university president?
So, I grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
So you carpetbagged in Arizona?
I moved to Arizona after law school. Got a job there. You know, I moved to Arizona after law school to be a law clerk to a federal judge. I knew no one except the federal judge. And 25 years later, I was governor. So things happen, right? You know, my parents were, they never said, Janet, you're going to grow up to be governor. What they did do, however, was encourage me. You know, if I wanted to take clarinet lessons, take clarinet lessons. If I wanted to go backpacking on a weekend, go backpacking on a weekend. I mean, they gave me a lot of freedom to experiment and to try different things. And they were always there. They were always very supportive. I was very fortunate in the parents that I had.
Here's a question from Rick. Tell us your most entertaining story about working with President Obama.
No. I can't tell that story. but I will, you know, look, I met President Obama in 2004 at the Boston Democratic National Convention, where he gave the speech that blew the roof off the place. You know, we don't live in red states or blue states. We live in the United States. I met him because I was the speaker right in front of him at the convention, and I'm so grateful I wasn't the speaker after him. Right, that would have been awful.
Who followed him? Do you remember?
No, and that's very symbolic. So, but we just had a kind of an instant connection, and he was talking to me throughout 2007, and. I was pleased to be an early supporter of his.
That was not an entertaining story about him.
That's all you're getting from me, buddy.
All right. Here's anonymous. There's a number of anonymous questions. How do you reconcile the number of deportations that took place during the Obama administration with the good work of the administration on immigration, such as DACA?
Yeah, so... we did have a high number of deportations under the Obama administration. We were focused on prioritizing those deportations. We were focused on those in the country illegally who had violated other criminal laws, those who were known gang members, those who were known national security risks, and those we apprehended right at the border, so that we were putting people into deportation proceedings before they got into the country, became members of the community. At the same time, we ended workplace raids, and we created DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. So we did DACA when I was secretary. We didn't know when we started it whether we'd have, 500 or 5,000. Now there are 800-some-odd thousand young people who are enrolled in DACA. We think we have around 4,000 at the University of California. So when the administration announced that it was rescinding DACA, at the University of California, we took the next logical step, which is we sued them, which I think makes me the only cabinet secretary to have sued her successor. And we got the injunction, and DACA has been in place ever since, but this is an area where we sorely need Congress to act.
Can you... Devin McBride's question. Can you speak to the dangers of not having a permanent Secretary of Homeland Security and other DHS positions currently, as well as not having a permanent Secretary of Defense or permanent president? Or no.
I think the turnover in the cabinet and in the upper levels of the administration it's not good government. It doesn't allow for stability. It doesn't allow for good decision-making processes. I think that the turmoil at DHS certainly doesn't make us safer, and certainly doesn't make us feel safer.
So Anonymous also asks, Janet, as a woman working in a male-dominated field such as Homeland Security, how did you find the workplace culture?
I found it very, very good. It is male. When I was a U.S. attorney and when I was an AG, law enforcement is heavily male. I think you just go into any room, any meeting place, know your stuff, be prepared. It helps when you're sitting at the head of the table. I thought it was a pretty good working environment. I enjoyed the people I worked with very much.
When Cal plays UCLA, who do you root for?
I stay home.
All right, we're going to do one more question here. Let's find a good one. Okay. Anonymous also asks, if a young person were to ask you why they should have hope and where can they can make the biggest impact in our country, what would you tell them?
I'd say, look, I've spent virtually my whole adult life in public service. I I think, you know, government at all levels, local, state, federal. I think the opportunity to serve others is very motivating, very mission-oriented. And so I really try to encourage young people, don't give up the ghost. Don't give up the notion of public service. It's a great calling.
Janet Napolitano, she's going to be signing her book, How Safe Are We? Right now.
Right now. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Rusty Bacall and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And if you like the show, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find us. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back soon with another episode.